Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. How are you guys doing today? I hope you're doing fantastic. With us today, Derek Shang. And we're going to hear so much about real estate development in Manhattan, in the city. We've spoken about this a couple of times, but we have someone who is very, very excited and very much into educating you guys and everybody else who's listening. And you're going to get so much from this podcast. We're going to talk about prop tech also. So I can't wait. I'm not going to do this big introduction. I'm going to let him give us what he does. Tell us what he does. Derek, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Shai.
My pleasure. So, you know, before we start digging into your story, which is fascinating, let's, you know, give us a 2-minute elevator pitch of what is your business about today.
All right, 2 minutes. So I've been in real estate development for 10 years now. So I would say at this point, I am a moderate expert. I've been developing in New York City. And focused on multifamily residential. So I started by working for a developer for just about 5 years, worked on a ground up luxury condo right when things were really picking up in that market. And then we exited right when things were just starting to fall off a cliff. And simultaneously, I got a lot of experience working on a city scale project that developer had been leading in South Korea. So I got to see a lot of large scale things. Eventually I decided, you know, I saw a project end to end. Why don't I give this a shot, do this on my own? So for the past 5 years, I've been working for myself as a developer. So I've done 60 million of deals, multifamily rehabs, co-living since then. And I'm starting to build up a decent track record. And I like to differentiate by incorporating prop tech wherever I can, because my educational background is actually in engineering. So first and foremost, I see things through an engineering lens, and I try to optimize things and see if we can bring in technology solutions to solve a lot of the problems we come across as developers. So ancillary to the development business, I try to identify prop tech companies that can be accretive to whatever developments I'm working on. And if they're especially good, then I also consider investing in them, because if I want to be a customer, why not be also an investor? Because I figure as developers that are interested in prop tech, we kind of have this edge because we know the failure points, the pain points,
the need. And
yes, we know firsthand, and not necessarily all VCs can have that kind of foresight to see or to have lived through the problems that we have and understand whether some solution can truly address those problems. So in a nutshell, my business is real estate development plus prop tech investing.
Beautiful. And we have so much to talk about. That's without a doubt. You know what? Let's go back in time. Let's go to the DeLorean. Sure. Go back in time and tell us how you got into real estate in the first place. and your career and how you got into this whole thing.
Oh boy, if there is an unorthodox story, it's mine. So I actually started.
You know what they say?
Totally different.
Oh, you sorry. You know what they say? They say it takes one to know one. That's it. You know, unorthodox story. Yep. But go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
So, I mean, if I go back to school, I mentioned I studied engineering. This was back in like 2003. The housing market was insane. People were giving out 110% loans. You can figure out how old I am based on that. But I figured, you know, I'm doing engineering, but real estate's a hot market. And I eventually want to understand how to make a passive investment and generate income, have my money work for me, all that stuff, you know, like rich dad, poor dad stuff. So I decided to add a real estate finance minor in school. Took tons of finance classes, took tons of real estate classes, even hotel classes. And I was like, let me bookmark this. I'm going to get into real estate one day. So that's not what I did out of school. So I ended up at a defense contractor doing some of the most boring work ever, just controlling budgets, which oddly enough was very useful for real estate development later on. But I hated it so much that I decided, let me just become an entrepreneur. So I figured, let me monetize my passions. And at the time, I was obsessed with tennis. So I went ahead and started a tennis retail store. In retrospect, it wasn't exactly the smartest thing to do. Like with the rise of Amazon and, you know, retail, like there's a lot of competition out there and there's not a lot of areas to innovate. So I kind of brute forced it. Yeah. And I forced my way into the market. And things grew, but it wasn't exactly like 10x returns or anything like a startup. It was just a very traditional mom and pop type of store. And I learned a lot of things the hard way, put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to the point where it wasn't a passion anymore. That's one of the terrible ways to destroy your passions. Just like make it your business and not quite succeed. So I actually did exit the store. I sold it. It was mildly profitable. As a tennis store owner, I actually hung out a lot at country clubs. I was just kind of a fixture at all the country clubs all over Long Island. A lot of people knew who I was, and I was just mingling with a lot of high net worth individuals. So naturally, that led to a lot of connections where, if I wanted, I could have gone into a lot of different industries based on the relationships I was cultivating just purely by playing tennis with people. So if there's a lesson to be learned here, play tennis and golf to network.
Go play tennis.
So, yep. So I had met who my future employer would be, Stan Gale. He was one of my best customers in the store. And he was developing a city in South Korea that I alluded to earlier. And he was part of the Gale family. If you're familiar with the brokerages in Long Island, the Daniel Gale agency is kind of the patriarch of that dynasty. So Stan was the third generation, and he kind of took the whole family to another level by doing development all across the Northeast, Class A office space. And then he was put on the map by doing this ridiculous tower, the State Street Financial Building in Boston. He just built it on spec and then found a tenant to take the whole building and basically built it for $350 million, sold it for $750 million. Wow. Ended up on the front page in Wall Street Journal. And then the Korean government called him and was like, we're looking for an international developer to build a city for us. So that's how he got involved in a city scale development. And then somewhere along the line, I just appeared in his life. And I was like, I want you to be my mentor. I want to work for you. I'm willing to sell my store. Just let me be your intern. And at that time, I was like already 30. I was probably one of the oldest interns he ever had. But I was like, you know, career change. I bookmarked real estate. I still kind of know the numbers and stuff like that. This seems like a good time to finally get in. And this was after the recession. It was actually a very good time to get into real estate because it was just coming out of the bottom around 2010, 2011.
The best time.
Yeah. So, and he had, Stan had closed on a residential project in Manhattan. So that was kind of the beginning of it all. And I got to see the beginning of that. And so, yeah, I did end up selling the store. I did end up working for him full time. And that ended up launching my whole career in real estate.
How long was that? How long did you work for Stan?
So it was up until 5 years ago. So it was just about 5 years.
5 years working on mega scale, I'm assuming, meaning developments globally. And that was that's quite an experience. And today, from what I saw today, you are going for a very different type of developments. Maybe in the future, we'll go also for mega developments. But right now, very different types. If you're going to tell us about that, that would be great. You know what? Let's start with how do you start your own business?
Sure. The tennis one or the real estate
one? Not the tennis one, the real estate one.
Okay. So, I mean, the tennis one did definitely prep me because I wasn't afraid of being an entrepreneur. I had taken that dive before. And if you're watching and considering taking that step, just making the mental commitment is the single most important thing about becoming an entrepreneur, because it's very common for people to come up with excuses of why something won't work. And then in retrospect, all it brings is regret. Like if you have an opportunity and you really want to do it, commit to it. And otherwise you have nobody to blame but yourself. So that second time around, it was much easier for me to make the commitment because I knew what I was getting into. But I will say, if you want to be a developer, you need two things. It's super important. One is money. The other is track record. If you have one or the other, you can't do it. And it's just this cold, hard truth about things. If you don't have enough money, you got to start with a small deal. If you got a track record, but no money, you got to raise money. But you're not going to have much of a share in whatever you develop if you don't put in the capital yourself. So you need a mix of both. It's very hard to raise money if you don't have that track record. So I had some cash saved up, and I was ready to go. And then in terms of track record, I just kind of use my Gale experience as a starting point. But it was difficult in the beginning. So I found a partner. Her name was Yuri O. And she also had cash plus a growing track record. She was doing a ground up development all by herself up in Harlem. It was luxury condos. And we had decided that if we teamed up, we have enough cash to do a moderate size like townhouse type deal. And she also had a lot of high net worth connections. So where
was the first deal?
First deal was in Hell's Kitchen on 47th Street.
So making a first deal and actually in Manhattan is you have to be brave to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't her first deal. And then I was very familiar with
I'm talking about the
construction
capital
in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I did fail to mention I did buy my first personal property, investment property, back right around when I met Stan Gale. So I did go through one closing. It was a very small property. Still own it today. Still cash flows very well. So I did have that on my track record. It wasn't much to brag about and definitely not enough to raise money off of because it was just not in the same ballpark at all. But as I was saying, Yuri did come with a lot of connections, and there was one investor just ready to go. And I think this is where I had a lot of luck on my side, because that investor was willing to back me. And I recognized they were willing to take a leap of faith in me without having done any development on my own before. And in return, I was like, I threw a promote out the window, because I was like, you know, I'm just happy to get started. So
great attitude.
Yeah. So I approached my first project with that mindset. Like, I don't want to screw this up, and I just want to make sure that I have a solid property on my track record. And then from there on, things will get a little bit easier.
What type of property was that again?
So it was a 5-story walk-up that we purchased from a nonprofit. It was totally vacant. And at the time, co-living was starting to become more popular. It was gaining traction. It was like a buzzword in the industry. And I had some unique connections, because I had known the founder of Common Living through one of my contacts at Gale. And I actually did a little bit of technology consulting for them right when they started up. And it put me in this unique position when I was looking for my first deal to understand that co-living offered outsized returns for very specific types of properties. And by specific, I mean it has to be able to be densified for co-living to a certain point. At which point, if you have the right number of bedrooms, you get a rental uplift. So the 47th Street property just happened to be one of those, and I recognized it right away. I talked to the people at Common. The numbers worked out. So it ended up being the first co-living building in Manhattan. So that was actually a big PR point for us. And on top of that, I made it the first sustainable co-living building in Manhattan, because again, I was a prop tech nut back then. I had studied a lot of real estate technology working for Gale. So I was like, you know, I kind of have a blank canvas here. I have an investor that believes in me, gives me a lot of freedom to do what I want with this property. So even though some things didn't necessarily have a quantifiable return, it had intangible qualitative returns. Like, putting solar panels on a building didn't necessarily make sense. But if you look at the satellite view, I'm the only one with solar panels in Hell's Kitchen. And it sticks out. People notice it. I did a green roof. I did all sorts of like interesting things with artificial lighting. I did motion sensor lights, low flow fixtures. If I were to get LEED certification, it'd probably be, probably could be LEED certified. I just didn't want to spend the money on that. But I put in a lot of sustainable bells and whistles in there. I think it turned out well.
Listen, this is an amazing story. I want to ask you this. Did you continue with the co-living concept, or that was it and you went on to condo development and else, you know, or you went elsewhere?
So I did an additional 2 co-living buildings. At one point I brought 10% of the co-living stock in New York City. So I may have been the leading co-living developer at one point. I'm not sure anymore. I don't really track those metrics.
But what did you call the company, by the way?
That was called YD Development. But I've since actually wound that down, because I can get into that later, but Yuri's been in South Korea, hasn't been able to really help out over here. So it made sense for me to just team up with another company. But again, I'll talk about that later.
No problem. Listen, I'm looking forward to that. So tell us a little bit about the shifting gears and the going forward to the next developments and the types of developments. And tell us a little bit about that activity later on.
Yeah, so co-living was definitely on an uptrend all the way through the pandemic. And I was trying to stay on the forefront of it. And I was trying to build out a whole portfolio of co-living buildings. And I had, right after I closed on my third project, I was on a exponential trajectory. It was becoming easier to raise money. So I went from 47th Street was a $11 million deal. Then I did a $13 million deal. Then I did a $35 million deal. So each time I was like, let me keep doubling. then the pandemic hit. And that same, the summer right before that, New York City had passed some super stringent rent stabilization laws. You may be familiar with them.
Yes.
Yeah, it destroyed a lot of business models out there. And it upended my entire closing process and my plans for the building. But we still pushed through and got it done. And the pandemic really it tested me. I was saying before we started this call, it's character building. And it was probably one of the toughest things I've gone through in my professional life. I had a lot of sleepless nights, just figuring out, you know, how to stay current on the loans, how to keep on schedule, for the projects, how to occupy the buildings that were completed. So I think if you're in the development business long enough, you're going to go through a downturn. So that was kind of my trial by fire.
Tell me something. And how did you keep, sorry, I'm stopping you. Just very curious about, you know, pandemic hits, especially co-living is one of the, you know, most, I would say, soft targets that, you know, it's a target. It's definitely a target.
Yeah.
How did you, meaning, overcome that? Meaning, obviously, people, you know, with social distancing and everything that is going on or went on, how do you overcome that? Getting people into the building, a co-living space, what adjustments you had to do?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. I'd love to hear it.
So there is a spectrum of asset classes, and they all got hit in different ways when the pandemic got hit. So for New York City, everything was negatively affected, except for logistics centers. I'm not going to talk so much about outside of New York City, but quick summary there, it went in the opposite direction. But for New York City, logistics centers went up, and then apartments, like, you know, regular residential, survived. Co-living did pretty poorly. And then hotels got destroyed. Retail, dead. And then office was probably at the bottom. So I think in that sense, I'm thankful that I was in residential because people needed to stick around in their apartments, and they were still paying rent for the most part. While a lot of people were fleeing the city, but I mean, if I were in office or if I was in retail or hotel, I probably would have defaulted. So, but again, co-living was worse than regular residential because ultimately it's flexible living. Your lease terms are shorter on average, and you just had to pick up your suitcase and go. So we had a lot of turnover during that time, and it's a little bit more like mark-to-market rents because you're just reacting to whatever the market pricing is when people move in. Whereas with residential leases, you can kind of play games with setting a contract rent and then giving concessions. You got people in for 1 to 2 years at a time. So that's why I went through a lot of pain as a co-living landlord and developer.
Character building, as you called it.
Yes. So how did I survive? I would say just pure grit. I just refused to die. There was a lot of instances where that happened throughout the 6 months after the pandemic hit. I could have folded, but I was just willing to sacrifice my own health. I did go through some health issues later on, but I was like, this is my track record. Do I want to say I folded in the face of adversity, or I survived COVID and I didn't miss a payment, and you know, the buildings are actually doing okay now. So it just took a lot of like replanning, and then a lot of creativity on cost cutting and marketing the units, keeping them occupied. And then, yeah, it was a whole combination of little things. I was just pinching every single penny I could.
So I'm assuming you had to halt acquisitions. You had to go and buckle up and really hold on to what he had, and thank God you still have it and still there. And then post pandemic, what happens?
So if you've been following the headlines, New York City rents have been hitting all time highs one month after another. So this is almost like sweet payback, because the buildings have recovered a lot faster than I anticipated. The rents are super healthy. We're probably going to hit our original pro formas this summer. And I just did not see that happening. If you asked me that a year ago, I wouldn't have believed it. So, we're on track to do quite well, and then refinance probably in the fall when we show some very healthy stabilized numbers. So that'll be really my first exits ever since I got started.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. And then regarding the acquisitions you mentioned before, I actually didn't put it on hold because I had recognized during the pandemic, a lot of the values of these properties, they just tanked like 30-40%. And it's a little bit strange dichotomy in the market right now, because you see the headlines about the rents going up. But if you look at investment sales, the property prices are still kind of depressed. And that's indicative that the cap rates are actually decompressing. And that's also a function of the interest rates rising. So I think it's still a good time to invest in New York City. And especially during the lockdowns, right after the lockdowns, I saw some of the best deals I've ever seen. Even before I got into real estate, I did kind of keep track of what prices were in Manhattan. And I didn't see prices like that since 2007. So there were some deals to be had, but it was just incredibly difficult to raise money, because if you just plop money in crypto or the stock market, you are getting 2-3x returns within weeks. And people are like, I'm becoming a millionaire just pressing buttons on my phone. Why should I sit in an asset for 5 to 7 years with you with 15% IRRs? So even though the deals were there, it was just really hard to raise money during that period. So I just had a deal drought for a while.
Tell me something. You know, going into today, what type of deals you do today?
So I recently started a condo conversion. And if you check my YouTube channel, I've decided to document the entire thing and show behind the scenes what goes on from a developer's point of view. So this one's in Midtown West. And I kind of decided, you know, let's hit the reset button. I joined another firm as a partner. It's called Clear Mountain Capital. And they had just closed on this property in December of last year. And they brought me on because they don't actually have a New York City pipeline. And this was their first New York City deal. They haven't done a condo conversion before. Whereas I've seen this stuff, I've been breathing this stuff for the last 10 years. So I knew what they were getting themselves into. And I was able to help out from day one. So I'm also invested in the deal. And the reason why I think condo development right now is the way to go is because there's a lot of political hazards in the near term that I see. And the biggest of which is good cause eviction, which you may have heard of. But I think any developer and landlord has been hearing whispers about it, and it is one of the most ominous pieces of legislation I've ever seen. If it makes the 2019 rent stabilization laws look like child's play compared to what they're planning. And it's effectively going to cap rent increases on every single apartment in the city. And
yeah, that could be disastrous.
Yeah, that's devastating if you're a landlord. And it kind of encroaches on the definition of ownership, because if you own a piece of property and the tenant has a right to stay indefinitely and renew indefinitely, like, where do you draw the line? What if the landlord does need to do something with the property or wants to do something with the property? I understand there's nuances about the bill that allow some flexibility there, but I think it's very dangerous for the New York City market, because I personally do not want to touch rentals anymore. I'm pretty heavily weighted in it right now. And even though the rental market is shooting up, what happens if I have to cap my rent increase, and I can't move mark to market?
Kills the deal.
In co-living, that's especially dangerous given what just happened in the pandemic. Like, if my rents drop 40% and I have to increase it 3% at a time, how many years is it going to take before I get back to where I was to start with? And on top of that, the property taxes have been historically increasing 8% a year. So that's dangerous if my margins are squeezing and I can't raise the rents. I won't be able to pay for maintenance. So instead of like actively protesting something like this, I just figure, you know, follow the free market.
Condo.
There's other opportunities.
Yeah, condo development.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you know what? I looked at your YouTube channel. We just spoke about this before the interview.
Yep.
I just loved it. And I suggest everybody should subscribe to your channel, because it's just pure education. And it's amazing how you do it. You just point out not only how a developer points of view, but a developer points of view, meaning in terms of the collaboration with the team and how important is the team and what are you as a listener and a problem solver to bring them all together. It's an amazing thing. So I suggest everybody who is listening to this show, you guys have to go to the YouTube channel of Derek Chang, and we're going to
Real Estate for Noobs.
You can look at the links here, and you guys, we're going to say it again, probably in the end, but anyways, it's an amazing thing, and kudos to you. Really. It's an amazing
thing.
Thank
you.
Tell me something. I just want to go back for a little bit and talk a little bit about, you know, a person who gets into real estate development or real estate, doesn't matter, operational part, ownership, you want to do acquisitions, whatever you want to do, you need to get financing. And we're going to talk about the equity. And you did speak about the equity. You had a backer, you had someone, you found someone's relationships.
Yep.
Awesome. Let's talk about the, you know, the debt. Let's talk about the senior debt financing. How hard is it to get it in the very beginning? And how did you do that? Because that's one of the biggest, I would say, obstacles. Tell us a little bit about that and growth and the treatment from the banks within time.
Yeah. So I would say there's two paths come to mind. One is the long but sure path of, you know, just slowly building your credit and your track record. And as you do more and more, say, house flips, you'll eventually start getting to a size where you can do a multifamily deal and then, you know, commercial size deal. I took more of a shortcut because I didn't have the balance sheet to borrow like commercial deal size loans and to guarantee those kinds of loans. So again, the first deal, I got lucky because the investor took a risk. So I structured in a very non-traditional way. And this is something you can learn from. If you want to take a shortcut, try something non-traditional. Our cap stack actually didn't have a commercial lender on it. We had a private loan with the investor, which is also very strange. They lent money from their left pocket to their right pocket. and So we had a construction loan, but it was just with the investor at a fixed interest rate. So, and again, I recognize that if I just make the sacrifices in my own promote and my profits and all that in the first deal, it's worth so much more to me to have that track record. So second deal, I took another shortcut of just partnering with someone who had the balance sheet. So I had a co-GP on it.
You could sign the loan.
Yeah. So you can, like, the reason why I was able to go from 11 to 13 million to 35 million was because the second and third deal, someone signed the loan. So after the big one, 35 million, the current condo conversion I'm doing is 8 million. It's technically the smallest project I've worked on. So bankers look at me and say, you know, this one should actually be easier for you, or easy for you, because it's the smallest thing you've ever done. So I'm at that point right now where it's not difficult for me to get a loan that size. So I figure, like, as I'm recovering from the COVID aftermath, if I just do a series of these smaller deals, it's relatively straightforward to get bank loans for me at this point.
Love the answer. You know what? Before the show, and meaning also after we started recording, basically you started speaking about PropTech, and we shared our mutual excitement about this. Tell us a little bit about, let's start this conversation, this part of the conversation with, from the bird's eye view of PropTech. If you could tell us your view of why is it important, what it is, and how you would like to be a part of it. And then we'll start digging into technologies. Go ahead.
Sure. So bird's eye view, PropTech is kind of like the last frontier of VCs. And there's a lot of reasons that it's turned out this way. A lot of it is just rooted in the culture of commercial real estate, and like all the stuff we have to think about and deal with before we even start considering PropTech. There's just so many hurdles, so many problems we have to solve. So PropTech is really supposed to solve development problems, management problems, construction problems. It's a category of startup technology companies that are, I would say, unsuccessfully trying to disrupt real estate because real estate is just too big and too segmented for it to really happen. So we can dive into this, but I have so many thoughts on what can do well and why a lot of things haven't done well to date.
Okay, so I'll tell you what. I agree with a lot of things that you said. I can tell you that one of my interviews with one of the prominent VCs, you can go back, what was his name? I forgot right now. I'm gonna go back to it. A lot of interviews that I've done. But basically, the mention was, I asked, what do you think we are today? Are we late? He said, we are exactly where we should be. Why? Because the evolution of it is just, natural evolution. In the beginning, nobody believed it. Then we started implementing some technologies. Then we found out the flops. Now we're, figuring out the rest. There are certain things that are still not there. There's a lot of work to do. But definitely we're in the right direction. And I think that, the innovation is right up there. And I love the way you put it out. PropTech is obviously the umbrella word for all those things. You have fintech within it, you have construction tech, and you have property management and different systems within property management. And it goes on and on and on and on. I would like you, if you could educate us with your perspective as a developer, what technologies you're looking at to help you with your process.
Sure. I think I want to start by saying that I look for technology existing on a particular part of the adoption curve. And if I were to loosely describe it, it's a bell curve. On the left side, you've got the early adopters. In the middle, you've got critical mass. And at the end, you've got the laggards. And the lifespan of this curve can take place really over any period of time. It really depends on the market you're in and how easy it is to gain traction and users and all that stuff. So in real estate and in prop tech, that curve tends to be much longer because if you think about the life cycle of a building, buildings are built to last centuries. Like New York City buildings, they're as old as 300 years old. And I'd say the majority are still approximately 100 years old at this point. Like the walk-up townhouses, they're all built in the early 1900s. So when you're trying to incorporate technology into a development, you have to think in the long term. And that is a real difficult thing to do for prop tech companies, especially if they're working in hardware that gets installed on the site, because they're not thinking in the long term. They're thinking about how they're going to achieve the user growth necessary to make their VCs happy. So they'll iterate, they'll pivot, and you'll end up with a product that's outdated before you've installed it. So that is one of the biggest challenges I encounter. And I try to see if there is any potential that a company is going to pivot and abandon me.
Give us an example. Give us an example of what you're talking about. You know, sure. Don't mention companies. Just, you know, say this type of technology, here's the solution that they're coming with. Here's where they try to impress the VC and everything could go south. Tell us a little bit.
So let me give a hypothetical. Suppose you have, when I was first looking at home automation technology, suppose you had a home automation controller based on an Apple device, an iPad, and you install that and, you know, it costs, let's call it $50,000 to install the whole system in your mansion. Fast forward 5 years, and it's on an iPod Touch. When's the last time you used one of those things? Does it even get firmware updates anymore? Does your system work anymore? I don't know. Like that's one of the huge hurdles that you have to deal with. And you know, it's when you're working with hardware, it's got software embedded in it, and sometimes the operating systems are just terribly outdated. Just 5 years down the road. And like you can't remotely support these things anymore because the software can't communicate with the computers you're working on anymore. So that is one of the big red flags I look out for, how robust their hardware and software is to stand the test of time. And then like, it's not so much of a problem if you're using something like software as a service, because you're just paying for something and it's the job of the company to keep the software up to date. You're kind of insulated from any outdated hardware issues.
So let me just barge in on that, because I love this. Mm-hmm. I love what you've just mentioned. But let me just come in. A part, and that's my, I'm wearing the hat of a former investor, basically in prop tech. When we looked at those type of companies, one of the things that we really cared about was a budget that they put out as a development budget, meaning they have to realize, because we're talking about technology and it's not real estate, we're talking about technology. We know that within 2 years, your tech is already as dead as can be. You know, 2 years, 3 years, it's like dinosaur. Therefore, you have to have a certain budget, meaning obviously to run the company, to build the company, to for the growth of the company. And then you have the tier on top of that, which is the tier for the development of the tech. Meaning you have to have this stack of money that is you put out for the VC. It's more money to ask for, but it's very, very important to have it there, because you're showing, hey, I know that in 3 years, I'm a dinosaur. I'll need that money to get more developers, to get, you know, younger people, or to get newer technologies in order to redevelop or to further develop whatever we have for the further development of this technology, to get better and better and better, to have more services, better technology, et cetera. So that's, I think, is the key, is to put in a budget from day one that solves that problem. That shows VCs or shows even real estate companies, I'm coming with a solution with it because I have the budget for 2 years from now, because we are continuously, we have a team with an R&D, this, you know, continuously looking to how to get better and better and better. We don't just sit there and say, hey, we're doing great. There's no great. So that's, yep, that's my take on that.
Yeah. And it also helps if the founders of these companies really have a deep understanding of what we do as developers, because if they have that empathy of knowing our thought processes, then it follows that they're going to plan ahead for, you know, obsolescence, planned obsolescence, or rather preventing the obsolescence.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that. Meaning when they know what type of problem they are solving, meaning they understand the thought process of, meaning operators and developers and whoever's in the industry, that comes with, that goes without saying. We take them much more seriously. Yeah. So what I wanted to ask you basically is, before we set our goodbyes, people are listening to this and they are curious. They want to get in touch with you. They want to learn more about you because you are a tremendous, not only a developer, you're not only a guy who went through stuff and taught himself how to get into this whole thing. You're not only involved in PropTech, but you're an educator, and takes one to know one. So I want you to tell everybody, and you guys can see the links above and below, tell everybody how they can learn from you, get in touch with you if they want to invest with you or want to join you or want to partner up with you. Tell us a little bit of how to find you and what type of systems you have there.
Sure. So I, of course, run the Real Estate for Noobs YouTube channel. I actually have a TikTok account as well. And I do a mix of short form content, long form content. I talk about all things development and prop tech. You can, of course, find me on LinkedIn. I have my LinkedIn link in all my videos. And generally, if you're looking for advisory in development, or if you would like to invest, or if you have a deal you'd like me to JV on, I'm open to anything. So feel free to hit that connect, like, and subscribe.
You guys definitely do that. I already did. And it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to have someone like you with, you know, with us. And it was tremendous. We heard a lot of beautiful things. We learned a lot. Derek, thank you so, so, so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Yishai.
No problem. You guys, I hope you enjoyed it. And I'll see you in the next show. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.